our role is more in the darkness versus light analogy, right? We're there to expose bad things and shine a light on it. We're there to write and report and call it as we see it and to apply the same rules to this administration as we would apply to any other. That's what any president should expect of the press. It's what all of our readers should expect us to do. You got to just tune out the noise and put your head down and do it.
Hello, this is the Great Battlefield Podcast. I'm Nathaniel G. Perlman. A great political battle is being fought right now between progressives and the forces of reaction on the other side. This show is about the political entrepreneurs and other progressive leaders who are finding new or improved ways to fight. I was really glad to have the chance to talk politics and journalism with Anne Geeran. Anne is a White House correspondent for The Washington Post with a focus on foreign policy and national security. She previously covered the Hillary Clinton campaign in the State Department for The Post. Before that, she worked at Associated Press as chief diplomatic correspondent, Pentagon correspondent, White House reporter, and national security editor. Beyond that, she's a near neighbor, and I see her on the TV from time to time. Anne and I had a very good conversation about how to cover this unusual president, among other things. It's well worth your listen. So, after a quick word from our sponsor, my interview with Anne Geeran of The Washington Post.
This episode is brought to you by Graphicacy. Graphicacy is an analytic design firm that can help you advance the mission of your organization using your own real data and information. They are 21st century visual communicators who create interactive graphics, motion graphics, and data visualizations. You can find Graphicacy at graphicacy.com. That is GRAPHICACY.com. With Graphicacy's help, you can visualize a better world.
Hi, Anne.
Hi, Nathaniel. Happy to be here.
Do you mind introducing yourself and giving me a quick biography?
Sure. I'm Anne Geeran. I'm a White House correspondent for The Washington Post. I've been at the Post about 8 years. Before that, I was at the Associated Press for essentially a journalistic lifetime. And my main coverage areas have been foreign policy and politics.
One doesn't get to The Washington Post. I mean, it's one of the tops of the game of journalism, right? Without having paid some dues. How did you get going in journalism?
The fun story there is that my parents were both journalists and met at a newspaper in Michigan. And my first paying job was as a newspaper delivery kid back when that was a thing in upstate New York. And those familiar with the weather in Rochester, New York will know that there is some snow involved. So that's how I got going in the newspaper business in general. I did the usual things. I worked for my college newspaper. I did some internships. And I came to Washington for a journalism job right out of college and essentially never left.
What was college for you?
I went to Allegheny College, which is in Meadville, Pennsylvania, also in a snowy part of the world and in the mountains in western Pennsylvania. And while there, I did a semester in London, working in Parliament, actually. That was my first real political experience. That was really fun. And then I did some journalism internships, including working for the Meadville Tribune.
This felt like along the way, this is where I'm going. My parents did this. Sometimes one doesn't want to do what
their
parents want.
I didn't, you know, it's really funny. I didn't think too much about the fact that my parents did it. I just found it extraordinarily fun to be part of a little band of merry pranksters at the college paper. Now, this is going back into the dark ages, but before the internet, you actually had to type things out and then cut out pieces of paper and then glue them to a big other giant piece of paper, which eventually got printed into a college newspaper. So there were a lot of 3 a.m. pizza and beer filled deadline nights. And I just thought that was great. I loved all my colleagues. I liked the writing part of it. I liked the editing part of it. And sort of one thing led to another. I wish I could look back and say that I had some giant mission and I was driven to do this. And no, I just thought it was fun.
Most people don't know nowadays that cut and paste on the menu refers to...
Right, it actually referred to a physical process that you had to do. You had to cut it out and then stick it onto something else.
And my dad was a Shakespearean, and I used to see him typing away on the typewriter and then moving things around physically in the early days until the word processor showed up in the household, which was a lot later, actually.
Sure was, yeah. Yeah.
What was that first job out of college that you had in D.C.?
So I first worked for a couple of different television programs, actually. I don't know whether your listeners will recall John McLaughlin, but he had a couple of public affairs television programs.
He was very dramatic, I remember.
Yes, issue one.
Yes.
That was his big thing.
Yeah.
I worked there for a little while, a very, very little while. And then I was at CNN for a little shy of 2 years. I worked for the Larry King Live program when it first went on the air.
I used to listen to him on the radio in the middle of the night before that. And he was actually a pretty good interviewer, I thought.
He was a pretty remarkable interviewer. And he translated the radio interviewing skill to television. And in the first couple of years that he was on the air at CNN, it was basically radio on TV, taking live calls and all of that. And that was really fun. I was there greeting guests and putting people in taxi cabs and writing things and running around and ordering pizza and doing all the things you do when you're having your first real job. And that was fun. But I knew then that I didn't want to be in television production. I really wanted to get back to writing things and doing some reporting. So I went from there to a couple more internships, including at National Journal, a place called States News Service, which doesn't exist anymore, but has many, many, many alum around Washington. And eventually then on to the Associated Press, where that was my real career home.
When you were at the AP, what was your job there?
When I was very first hired, I worked for the Metro DC desk, and for a time I was on the night beat, and this was in I wouldn't say it was the heyday, but it was maybe just past the heyday of the Marion Barry years. And people who were around Washington at that time will recall that Mayor Marion Barry liked to entertain himself of an evening. And so more than once, it fell to me to call the police department in the middle of the night and call his office and try to get his spokesperson on the phone, and because he may or might not have been arrested, or he might or might not have done something or said something. That was a lot of fun. Then I was in Virginia for a while. I worked in the Richmond Bureau, which was as far south as I had ever been, except flying to Florida on vacation. And so that was a cultural experience. I liked Richmond. I liked working there. My first experience writing sports copy and radio copy and all of that. Then I was the Northern Virginia correspondent. It's like being a foreign correspondent. Like, you're responsible for everything. Real news, features, sports, anything that happened that was of real interest from your patch. And I always tell, when I talk to journalism students, that was my favorite job ever. I lived out of my car. I just drove all around. I decided what I wanted to do every day. As long as I was producing a lot of copy and making the editors happy, they were pretty happy to let me go do whatever I wanted to do. So I made a specialty of crazy crime, of which there was a lot in Northern Virginia. People think it's the placid suburbs, but there was a lot to cover there. I really enjoyed it. I had a great time.
A lot of people, their experience with writing is a little bit of suffering, you know, like procrastinating the paper in school. So do you suffer from any of that? Like, oh my God, I got to get this thing cranked out. I have a deadline. Or is it pretty routine for you?
Well, that's, you know, there's where the wire service will cure you of any woes you may have about making your prose perfect and spending lots of time picking just the right adjective. Because you just got to get that crap done. You got to file. It's got to be exactly a certain length. You got an editor waiting for it. I enjoyed that part. I had always been a pretty fast writer, but the wire service will make you a routinely fast writer for the rest of your career, which I've always been grateful for. And it also teaches you to frame the thing in your head very quickly. Like, I know these are the 8 things that have to go into the story. boom, 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 boom. Check my list, get it right, make sure it looks and sounds the way I want it to. It's pretty clear to me when I have an assignment or I've given myself an assignment what I want to go into it, roughly how long it's going to take. And then I don't usually find the writing process very hard. What I do have a hard time with is the part of writing for a place like the Washington Post that many people like the best, which is, you know, I get to crack my knuckles and write big for the Washington Post and do a big Sunday piece. And while I like doing that and I like the platform of doing it, I find it much more difficult than writing a solid, readable, smart, entertaining version of a spot story, which is kind of what the wire service teaches you to do.
What makes that so much more difficult or challenging, the Sunday, the big piece?
I think a couple things. One is that when you have more inches, when you have more room in the physical paper, which is still kind of how we think about a lot of these things, even though it's obviously journalism is almost entirely now an online reader experience for a lot of us who do it, we still kind of have in our heads the
physical space.
Right, exactly. There's an idea in your head of what it looks like. While I like the platform, I'm always grateful to have it. It feels like a much bigger canvas that needs to be filled with, I don't know exactly how to put it, but I guess
the art needs to be bit, like of a higher caliber, maybe.
Not so much of a higher caliber, but approached with a little different goal in mind, which is that you're going to explain something, show something. In some cases, although I don't do a lot of this, if you're in the investigative field, you're basically going to lay out a case for something or, you know, attempt to prove something with a lot more writing on it. The accuracy and readability of every piece means that there's a lot riding on it. But the kind of front page of the paper, big splashy photo layout, maybe even a three-part series, all those kinds of things. The size of the canvas of that, even at this point in my career, sometimes can be a little daunting. Once I get going, I'm fine. I just find it a little harder to get going.
When you write a sort of one of your regular pieces, how much interaction is there with an editor? How much does it change as a result of that, if at all?
That varies a lot, but in the main, I will either propose something as I, like I did yesterday. I said, hey, you know, this, when Trump came to the microphone and talked about Syria.
I watched that.
Yeah. So
it was remarkable.
It was. And, you know, somebody else who has been on the national security staff who's been writing the Syria story was going to write the news of it. He announced that we're lifting sanctions on Turkey and that he proclaimed that the safe zone is going to be an ongoing thing and that it's working and so forth. I proposed that I do an off-lead, like a separate look at the story, just looking at how Trump handled it. And in my thesis was that he's basically rebranding what his critics think is a big pile of doo-doo into something that he thinks is a political winner with his base. I proposed that. That didn't come out of the morning news meeting as what we call an editor-driven story. I just looked at that and thought about what I might want to write about it, proposed it. They agreed. It was pretty quick and easy to write, and I turned it in at 4:30 or so, and it was edited and out early in the evening. That is a pretty painless process, which is the way I would prefer to do it, where I come up with an idea and they think it's a good one. It doesn't always work that way. I'm sometimes given assignments. The challenge there is to make sure that you as the reporter think it's a good thesis, a good target, and that you then pull it through the way the editors want. Different newspapers have different editing cultures. That is something that has survived, even despite the vast changes in the way journalism is produced and consumed. The Post was historically considered less of an editor-driven paper than either the New York Times or the Wall Street Journal. I think that's still more the case than not. That doesn't change the fact that when an editor tells you to do something, they are your boss and they're telling you to do something.
That story about Trump and Syria statement, you said it was pretty straightforward and easy, but it strikes me as requiring an awful lot of knowledge of the whole scenario to put it together quickly and sort of an understanding of watching Trump for over a while. He really is doing something there, which is very characteristic of him, but it is not characteristic terribly of a lot of other presidents or leaders, right? I mean, there's something a little different. So how do you think that through? How do you do that from the lens of a reporter rather than like an opinion journalist or something like that?
You're onto something there. One, there's the value of being a beat reporter, right? It is my job every day to look at him, listen to him, think about what he's doing and why he's doing it. The subset of my beat at the White House is foreign policy and national security, which was my background covering State Department and Pentagon. So I come to it with a knowledge of the national security and foreign policy predicate here. And having covered other administrations, I come to this particular story with a lot of understanding of how he is doing it differently as a practitioner, as the person in our government who is now in charge of deciding what our national security and foreign policy priorities are and translating that into action. I kind of instantly know where and how he's doing that job differently. That obviously is true far beyond the Syria story. What interested me particularly about the Syria story and the way he talked about it yesterday was the fact that it is characteristic of him, as you say, to kind of turn what might be a debacle into a badge of honor. Well, of course I'm doing it differently. That's why I was elected. But to do it with this, where there's a Russia component, there is a sticking the finger in the eye of the Republican foreign policy establishment component. There are all of these currents that are coming together at a time when he is running for re-election under the threat of impeachment, and he needs Republicans around him to back him up. Instead, he's willing, because of his what he sees as his political instinct that is in touch with a current of the American electorate that is similarly isolationist, nativist, that he is willing in such a high profile, he was in the diplomatic room of the White House, to put that above all of these other concerns. So I just watched it, and then I sat at my desk and I watched it again, and then I, you know, wrote up a couple points of what I thought I would say in the piece and went over and talked to the editors.
For that, I'm trying to remember, you quoted some other people to make your points. I think you found some interviews or statements that others had.
I think there are only three other people quoted in it, and two of them are Republican senators who, you know, Marco Rubio, who put out this, to me, helpful tweet yesterday where he, right after Trump spoke, where Marco Rubio, who was, of course, one of his 2016 competitors and very much a part of the Republican foreign policy establishment, Marco Rubio saying, no, this is a terrible thing. Erdogan has not promised all the things that the United States is saying they promised. And Lindsey Graham, another Republican senator who also has been very critical of this decision, put out a more measured statement, but he was very clear that he thinks it was a bad idea to yank U.S. forces. And then I called a guy I've known for a long time, the former U.S. Ambassador to NATO, former Army General Doug Lute, and I just put the question to him. Did you watch this? What did you think of it? Do you think that the president is framing this in a realistic political fashion? Why might he be saying the things he's saying? And what are the consequences of those? You know, I find as an interviewer, if you just ask some open-ended questions, you usually have a general idea of what people are going to say, but not a very specific one. Just ask some open-ended questions and you'll, get some good quotes.
What seems notable is the gap between the specifics that Trump is dealing with and the statement that he makes. And I think there's something really fascinating about either his lack of knowledge or his disregard for knowledge if he has it, but I'm guessing a lot of times he doesn't have it. that's a beast of a different color there to report on, isn't it?
It is. I mean, it makes covering this White House, you know, one of the ways it makes covering this White House completely different than any other. And the value of having covered other administrations and other White Houses, you know, I think still holds up, though. The difference is apparent, and it should continue to be pointed out. What's fundamentally different is the president is banking here on the fact that he doesn't know things is perfectly fine and, in fact, beneficial, that he's here not to know things. There's some stuff he needs to know. And
perhaps his electorate is even further from the information than he is.
Right, right. And that is his point, that he understands what he's here to do. And all of the, you know, so-called experts with all their chin pulling and all of their, you know, tut-tutting don't actually know. That is an instinct that you see play out in a number of instances, but I thought it was particularly well encapsulated yesterday, where he makes this point a lot on the campaign stump or rally stump, but it pops up other places too. Like, who did it better? Like, look at all the dumb stuff that past administrations and all these smart experts have done. Why should I listen to that? Why should the fact that I color outside the lines be seen as a bad thing? Look at all the dumb stuff and all the messes they made, all the terrible things I inherited. I'm going to fix it. I'm going to do it differently. I'm going to break some china along the way, and perfectly fine. His political base loves that. And he's not wrong when he kind of returns to that core political mission as he sees it to be different. His critics will immediately say, yeah, well, you know, that he doesn't actually know very much, and he's making short-sighted decisions and a bunch of mistakes that all the rest of us will have to live with going forward. So far, his political base has not either agreed with any of that or penalized him in any way when he hasn't actually delivered on the promises that go with some of that rhetoric.
Well, one of the staples of his rhetoric, I guess, is that he deeply believes that saying something is good and saying that he's triumphed makes it so, right? There's just this, you know, I think it comes from, you know, the same thing as saying this is the greatest building ever, or it has more floors than it really does, or whatever. I mean, it's that propagandist in him that is unleashed all the time, right?
Yeah, and he routinely says stuff which is just immediately provable as not true, right? Like, he says, he does this all the time.
All day long.
And it must be, I'm not going to play too much of a pop psychologist here, but I mean, it just must be so much a part of his persona and his public presentation but that is, I think, a good example of where he would shrug and say, the people who elected me, the people who supported me and sent me here, understand that I am going to do things differently. And I don't play by the same rules. And that includes being, you know, given to exaggeration, let's put it that way.
Well, do you think he knows he's given to exaggeration? I mean, exaggeration, I'm sure he does, but deception. Or do you think that he believes what he's saying?
I don't know, but the fact that he does this routinely and
seems absolutely impervious to shame about it, or the criticism seems to roll right off him. Maybe even
enjoys
it.
Certainly, the criticism rolls off of him, and I have thought at times that he says and does things in order to invite criticism at times, because he likes a good fight. And a good fight, in his view, and he's got something to back this up, is politically beneficial for him. I don't want to seem like every answer goes back to his political base, but, you know, we are in election season, and basically everything does go back to his political base, so I'll use that as my excuse. His political base likes it when he is on offense, but they even like it more when they feel like he, as their champion, is being victimized by, you know, make a list, a million other external forces that they also feel, and often with some justification, are arrayed against them too. And so you'll see the president appear to pick a completely irrelevant fight. Or really, like, shouldn't you be talking about infrastructure today? And instead he's picking a fight, you know, with John McCain, right?
Or someone far smaller.
Correct, yeah. Some of that is clearly his own sense of grievance and his own personality. But some of it also is clearly a politically driven sense of being a champion and fighting.
And the serious story strikes me as just, I don't know whether it's genius to take what most people that know something about it thought of as a blunder. You know, a blunder in multiple ways, a blunder that might come back to haunt him down the road, and figure out an angle which ties it to his election persona, to something that actually got him there, and to something which he actually might be right about to some degree, right? Though it's untethered to the facts on the ground kind of dramatically. Do you think that this gives him a political advantage over other politicians?
Yeah. I mean, and it's already served him well, right? He just blows past the actual facts at hand and makes a separate case. The Mitt Romneys of the world are here to tell you that, you know, making a factual case and, you know, presenting it as in a debate format and telling the president that, oh, no, you're wrong, is completely irrelevant. It was irrelevant then. And from Trump's perspective, it's irrelevant now. The one thing I will say about the Syria thing that, you know, to be that chin puller for a minute is that, you know, one of the things that the president has done to good effect is to say, I am tough and my predecessors were weak. I am particularly tough on terrorism. I cleared out the caliphate. He's lately taken to saying that he's the one who actually beat the ISIS fighters and defeated them, and which I think might come as considerable news to the special operators in Syria. But be that as it may, if it turns out within this election cycle that a potent terrorism threat reconstitutes in this space that he helped make, I will wait to see how he gets out
he'll
of that
just,
particular
he'll
knot.
Just find a way to spin that, right, won't he?
Okay, so maybe I just want to, never mind.
I don't know. We'll find out. I mean, it does seem like, you know, in politics, it seems like things that you do that get you in trouble do tend to add up, right, over time. Like if you offend groups, but I don't know, people have short memories. I think part of what I see going on, and maybe you see it differently, I don't know, is there's a lot of efforts in this country to contain this president, whether it's within the government, within his own team, in the opposition. Some of them work. One example of that recently was him backing out of hosting the G7 at Doral, right? And it strikes me that it was his team that made him back off of that, right?
Actually, it was House Republicans.
Right, which is his team.
Yeah, right.
I meant Republicans. And so it was kind of an example maybe to them that they can oppose him if they're willing to, if they see differently on some subject. Talk a little bit about like the containment of Trump and trying to keep him between reasonable lines.
The reversing himself at 10:30 at night on a Saturday on the G7 by tweet is the only current example of him being pulled back or restrained that I can point to. In the main, he actually has been far less restrained the longer he's been in office. He has shed the original White House staff, which he helped pick, right? He made a lot of these personnel decisions with the knowledge that he was putting strong figures around him. A lot of the pearl clutchers breathed a small sigh of relief that, well, at least he's got Jim Mattis and company around him. But the Doral example is a particularly interesting one for a couple of reasons. One is that it comes in the context of impeachment. It said to me that the president is actually finally digesting the truth in front of him, which is that he is almost certain to be impeached by the House. And he cannot afford to have a whole bunch of House Republicans jump on that bandwagon because they feel that they had been given an indefensible set of presidential decisions, and that this was just one thing they couldn't swallow. It was actually a pretty easy thing for him to give up, right? He could back away from it and move on. And frankly, like in 2 months, is anybody going to mention this?
And he already got to advertise his place.
I suppose there's that, yeah. I don't know. I guess we'll see how the bookings look like at Doral next June, see whether it helped or not.
But that impeachment process in that regard is containing him in that example,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
And it might end up freeing him even more if he's impeached in the House and then the Senate quickly lets him off the hook and then he crows like he did after the Mueller report released that he's vindicated and feels, you know, unshackled by that.
Well, a lot of Democrats are actually concerned about that. That there are two ways to look at the impeachment calendar in the minds of a lot of Democrats at this point. One is that it is incumbent on Democratic leadership in the House to take this egregious example in their view of presidential abuse of power, put it to the test that the Constitution sets for us, do so quickly, do not make a giant political show of it, do it behind closed doors, get it done fast so that we can move on and do the people's business, right? That not only, you know, sort of sounds good, but that it is a good political winning argument when those House members are up next year. They can say, you know, we did exactly what the Constitution asked of us. For Democrats who are in districts where this is a winning argument, they can add to that, we held the president's feet to the fire, we didn't let him get away with it, blah, 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 blah. And in districts where the president is more popular, they can say, look, it was an unpleasant business, but we had to do it and we got it over fast. That's one side of that argument. The other side is no one is going to remember it. Like, he's going to be impeached by the House and acquitted by the Senate, and he's then, you know, it'll be months and months and months until the election, during which he can, to use your word, crow, but also during that period, the terms of that impeachment will be understood differently. He will have the opportunity to portray himself as a victim, which has been politically advantageous for him. Democrats will spend all of that time defending this and trying to keep it still in the relevant conversation where that's helpful. There are Democrats who are concerned that his ability to turn this around and say, yeah, the feckless Democrats, you know, impeached me 6 months ago, and what good did that do? What a waste of government resources that was. That will have resonance the closer to his reelection and theirs in the 2020 elections you get. I mean, obviously, I can't predict how that's going to go, but it is those two versions are very clearly now in the, you know, in the minds of a lot of Democratic strategists.
I read a brief thing in the Post, I think it was on your birthday. Someone asked you whether or not, what was like covering this administration? And you said it was something like it was a bonanza of news. At least as a reporter, it's yeah. Like, are you enjoying this sort of phase of your career where you're, where you're dealing with this bonanza of news?
Most days, most of the time.
Do you spend time worrying about the direction of the country while you're like reporting on it and like in the middle of it? Or like some people think that this is something different than we've ever faced as a country before, that we have someone with instincts that are not democratic at the helm. Do you worry about that? Or do you feel like this is politics as usual, maybe a little bit of a different personality mix?
Well, I mean, it's not in my professional purview to worry. It is in my professional purview to cast a skeptical eye and to put the president's words and actions to the test, right? I think it is clear, and I've said so in print, that, you know, the president is pursuing policies and adopting rhetorical habits that are authoritarian-ish, or certainly more like the authoritarians he admires around the world than they are like past presidents of both political parties. It is manifestly true that the president does not think that a lot of the principles of foreign policy, which is my main specialty, that past administrations have used as an operating ethos are worth it. I mean, the promotion of democracy around the world, the prevention of hostilities. I think he would argue that he did that in the case of Syria. Others would argue against. And the promotion of protection of human rights as a national concern. Those are messages that presidents of both political parties have carried into difficult parts of the world. And for Trump, that is just not what he thinks he's here to do. And he has that right. He was elected and he's the president. I think the other part of your question, though, is sort of like what it's like to be a citizen at the same time as you're in the midst of trying to cover the administration. And I think I read, I like to feel like I'm paying attention to more than what's happening at the White House. And although you didn't ask, I do vote. Some reporters don't. Some do. I've always felt that I can make a principled distinction between my rights as a citizen and the fact that I live in Washington, D.C. I live in a community where I want to, in addition to voting for president, where I want to vote for, you know, my local representation. I can make a principled distinction between that and between the administration I cover. And of course, I've been doing this a long time. So the experience of being a citizen in Washington during the Iraq War, for example, when, you know, it was a very politically charged atmosphere, and I was covering national security law issues, the terrorism issues and all of that, I didn't find it difficult to separate my rights and responsibilities as a citizen from my journalistic responsibilities. And although so many things are different about this administration, I don't really see the basic exercise of that division as different now than I did then.
You work for a newspaper that says democracy dies in darkness over the top of the name, which is pretty stark commentary right there. So I'm kind of curious how you view the role of the institution that you work for in this time in particular. What is the Post as a whole saying, and how do you fit into that?
Well,
and especially when it's being attacked by name, by the president.
Right. And some of
and
my colleagues.
Owner is attacked.
Yes. Our owner is attacked. Some of my colleagues have been attacked by name unfairly. It's perfectly fine to stand up for ourselves. You know, one never gets in trouble for quoting one's boss. And my boss, the executive editor of the Washington Post, Marty Baron, has a phrase which I think is very useful in this context, which is, we're not at war, we're at work. That sounds nice. But if you think about it, what he's saying there is really important. We are not the opposing force to the president. He likes to cast it that way. And the enemy of the people language, I think, is deeply corrosive and problematic. Having an enemy is good for him, and we're a convenient one. That isn't the way we do or should see our role. Our role is more in the darkness versus light analogy, right? We're there to expose bad things and shine a light on it. We're there to write and report and call it as we see it, and to apply the same rules to this administration as we would apply to any other. That's what any president should expect of the press. It's what all of our readers should expect us to do. You got to just tune out the noise and put your head down and do it.
I'm sure that in your role that you are speaking to many members of the administration at different levels and different departments. Is it your sense that most of those people are working in good faith to try to further the best interests of the country at this time?
I can't fully answer that, and it's not my place to judge the motives of most of the people I cover. I mean, some tell me their motives, so in that case, fine. I can say whether I think they're doing it or not. The president likes to rail against the deep state or, you know, radical unelected bureaucrats, as a new phrase the other day. That plays well to his base. But what he's referring to there is, you know, a phenomenon that other presidents of all parties have also complained about, which is the permanent substrate of government in Washington just sort of plows on, right? And some of the people I deal with are part of that. They're part of the machinery that imposes sanctions and figures out where military aid is going and how to process the military aid through the, you know, through the House and Senate and all of that, right? It can get in the weeds pretty quickly. And then, of course, there are the political figures who, you know, head up the various agencies and departments who, you know, were chosen and put there by the president. And, you know, that's a mixed bag. There are people who come out of established foreign policy experience on Capitol Hill, in other administrations, from academia. They're doing their what they're to do. I mean, that's, you know, those are some of the senior people in the National Security Council, for example, a couple of the senior people at the State Department. I find it helpful to try to seek out as many of those political appointees as possible and talk to them and try to put myself on their radar. Part of that is just, that's just what you do. It's what you do as a reporter. You try to make as many contacts as you can. But part of it also is they're the ones who are going to have their, have an idea of where things are going. Their finger is in the wind more effectively than many others. And so it's just really useful to me.
I mean, any time you're running an organization, I've run a small one in my day, you can't expect obedience out of all of you. out of everybody, right? They know better than you. Sometimes they have different opinions. Sometimes they're not persuaded that the direction is right. Sometimes they're too busy with other things. So there's something normal about that. Is there something that you see different with this particular president and his staff?
Oh, sure. I mean, his decision-making circle is really small, much smaller than any other president I've ever watched.
Is it one person?
No, it's not one person, but...
How many people would you say, would you guess?
Are really part of the central decision-making?
Oh, yeah, maybe he's talking to people, hosts on Fox News.
So there, unfortunately, there are two ways to answer that. Yeah. There are really only about five people who, you know, work for him, who are in that circle. And those include his daughter and his son-in-law. But he has a vast kitchen cabinet of people he talks to on the telephone. He talks to people on the telephone for hours at a time. And he is getting a lot of his information and he's making a lot of his decisions through those conversations. He is not as top down and, you know, l'état c'est moi as some of his critics say he is. In fact, one of the things he does on those conversations, other participants in those tell us, is he bounces ideas off people. Hey, what do you think about this? If I said X, what do you think would happen? And he's using a practice there that he found useful in business. And frankly, which, you know, heads of organizations to
go like
back.
It seems actually a reasonable process,
right,
a matter of who you choose to talk to.
It's just different than the process of meetings at the White House, which is the way administrations are used to running. And you hear lots of criticism of the president on the foreign policy sphere, particularly that he's broken the process. He's broken the NSC. The NSC is built to give him a menu of options, and those options are tested and thought through, and they're, you know, you go through basically mock trials, and you have input from all of the agencies, and da-da-da-da-da-da-da. He doesn't care. He doesn't want all of that. And I'm not saying that he doesn't care about the NSC, but that entire mold and process of bringing a menu of options to the president and having this rigorous policy debate where things are war gamed out and so forth is just not the way he does business. And there's a version of that process that is continuing to take place. And then there's him talking on the phone to Sean Hannity and his old business partners and his golf partners and his friends from New York and his lawyer, Rudy Giuliani, and coming up with different ideas and saying, no, this is what I'm going to do.
I think I read reporting that we were 10 minutes away from bombing Iran recently, and that he changed probably as a result of some conversation like that. Is that right?
He had been given a set of military options, and he picked one, which was to do a limited series of airstrikes. Our reporting, I think, identified three sites, and I think it's not entirely clear whether he would have done all three or he would have done one of the three or something. But in any event, that process worked. There was these are some targets that would be considered commensurate and proportional to the shoot down of an American surveillance drone, which is how this thing started. And, would be defensible in international law, would not freak out the allies, all those sorts of things, right? And he had agreed, at least in principle, or people around him thought he had agreed to go ahead with it. He has said that he never thought it was a good idea. And that while he considered it, he then decided against it because he then asked a bunch of questions about what the civilian or other death toll would be. There probably wouldn't have been a lot of civilian deaths, but there definitely could have been some deaths of Iranian military personnel at these facilities. He may be inflating the estimates of how many would have died. But his point is that he decided that even though the loss of this drone was egregious and deserved condemnation and couldn't go unpunished, that killing people wasn't the right response, wasn't a proportional response in his view. There's a whole set of fascinating discussions that go around there. I mean, it's hard to argue against not killing people, right? Like, he's onto a couple things there. One is that his political base, to go back to this, could have very easily seen this as the president going back on his word that he wouldn't get the United States involved in Middle East conflicts and that it's somebody else's job to do that, and all those sets of arguments that you have heard him make in a slightly different context in the Syria example. He really genuinely thinks that that could have gotten the United States into a war, and he doesn't want a war. He was willing to take the perception that he was weak in not pushing the button in order to make the larger calculation that he ultimately would have been the political loser if this had become a war. The second thing he wanted to do there is actually more interesting to me, which is that he genuinely thinks he can negotiate with the Iranians. And at some point, some American president is going to have to do it. I mean, if you just look geopolitically at where the United States is and where Iran is, they are on a collision course to eventually either have a war or have a big talk. And if President Trump is the guy who can have a big talk and make things better, great, right? Who doesn't want that? But he's widely criticized for being naive in his view that the simple invitation to Iran is going to be enough. It certainly hasn't been yet. But he sure as heck felt that blowing up an Iranian missile launching facility or whatever would have made that negotiation impossible, at least in the short term. And he is probably right. He wasn't like not doing it made the Iranians come to the table. But if he had done it, they really absolutely could not have even begun to consider it. And perhaps by next year or so, they might be in a position where they could consider it. I don't rule it out.
Yeah, he's strong-minded in a peculiar way that you don't see among many individuals that walk the planet.
Well, he's completely confident in his own ability to do things. In this case, he's confident in his ability to do something that basically everybody around him says isn't going to happen, right? The Iranians are not in a position right now where they can talk to him. But he thinks they are or will be. And I think his instinct to refrain from that airstrike, there's something behind it. He was onto something there.
I think you're someone I could probably talk to all day, but I want to respect your time. And so I wonder if there's a question that you always wished you were asked and haven't been asked that would like to take a swing at or would.
Well, let's see. There's a famous quote that General David Petraeus said about Iraq, and it gets misused a bit, but he said, "How does this end?" And his point there is that you shouldn't start something unless you have a fairly clear idea of how you're going to end it. I don't know how my journalistic career is going to end. I'm both energized and exhausted every day by covering this administration. And if Donald Trump is reelected, I think a lot of us are going to have a question to ask ourselves, can we physically do this for another 4 years? Or is he going to just exhaust us all? I don't know. I think the on balance, the excitement and interest of doing this job, no matter who's president, makes it worth doing as long as you can do it. I could see another chapter of writing about things in a different way. And at my age, I'm about the same age as you are, I think. You know, I'm starting to think, yeah, maybe there'll be other ways to continue to write, but to do it a little differently.
Write a book.
I don't, yeah. Everyone keeps asking me, well,
When's your book?
Yeah. I'm like, I don't know.
That's a whole nother
Maybe. It's a whole other thing.
Well, thank you so much. Real honor to talk to you today. Anything else you want to say?
No, thank you so much for having me. I really enjoyed this. I'm thrilled to have been asked.
Thank you.
Thank you.
That was Ann Gearin. She is A. Gearin on Twitter. Ann and reporters like her make the Washington Post a great institution. This is Nathaniel G. Perlman with the Great Battlefield Podcast. You can find us at resistance-board.com or by searching for Great Battlefield in places where podcasts are found.